Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the USS Enterprise.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation, Deep Space Nine. It's a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are just a little bit embarrassed about having a Star Trek podcast. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison. Just turned off the space heater in my studio.
You got the heat on. It's 70 degrees out there, man.
This building is made out of cinder blocks, and they get all cold overnight, and it doesn't warm up because I put insulation in the roof. That was like one of the big expensive things we did when we moved in, as I insulated my studio. But what it means is it just stays cold as hell.
You know what? That's the recipe for wearing a little blanket over your legs all the time when you're doing a show.
I'm just like John Voight, wheeling around in my office chair, playing FDR.
I'm really excited for when we go over the did you like portion of the episode and you summon the will to stand up from your office chair.
Ahistorically, I stand to make my point.
The Michael Bay version of the did you like. Very inspirational. It's crazy that that for all of the things that Michael Bay's Pearl Harbor that people hated about that movie, that was like 10th on the list.
Oh, yeah. If that. I mean, yeah. Come on.
Were you excited for that movie before it came out? I was so excited.
I think I told you this, that when we saw the trailer for that.
Mm-hmm. One of the great trailers, I thought.
We're in the theater to see some other movie, and the trailer plays for Michael Bay's Pearl Harbor, and it finishes playing, and my mom leans over to me and goes, "Now that's filmmaking." I'll never forget that. That's like one of the funniest things she's ever done.
I wish there were more opportunities for, much like an author gets blurbs for their book on the back to entice you to buy their book. There should be more things with mom blurbs.
Oh, yeah. You
know? Mom's... The mom blurb is such a specific thing.
It really is. I mean, I feel like you kind of have to know the mom to know what that blurb means. Like, you've met my mom several times. You know what she means when she says, "Now that's filmmaking."
I mean, your mom is a great lady, and what I would take that to mean is that it's sincere.
Yeah.
And that is, in fact, great filmmaking.
It was 10 out of 10 sincerity.
The thing is, she wasn't wrong, because that trailer is everything that could possibly be good about the film that followed. Unfortunately, that was it.
They skimmed the cream off the, like a thin, thin layer of cream off the surface of that movie and put it in the trailer. And then all of the rest of the movie was like, what is this?
Pearl Harbor was great for exactly 3 minutes.
I think it also, I mean, I don't want to make this a Pearl Harbor podcast, but I think it also like felt really laser targeted at her because she was an Air Force brat and she spent part of her teenage years in Hawaii. Like her dad was stationed there.
I mean, we don't want to bite the rhymes of the Pearl Harbor podcast, a pod that will live in infamy. I mean, that show's already out there.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not already out there,
what are you doing?
I just conjured it.
Yeah, you just invented a whole new podcast.
Yeah,
I think, I bet if you called up our buddy Chuck Bryant and we're like, hey, do you want to do a minute-by-minute Pearl Harbor podcast called A Pod That Will Live in Infamy? I bet he would take you up on that deal.
Hey, Chuck, it's Adam Pranica.
Uh-huh.
Got a proposition for you.
Okay.
I want to do a podcast called A Pod That Will Live in Infamy, where we watch Michael Bay's...
You know, dude, I got a lot on my plate.
Sure.
But I don't want to wreck what you are trying to do, but I don't think I'm interested in being a part of it.
Michael Bay's Pearl Harbor is 300 minutes.
I know.
That would be...
You could make 6 years of content out of that thing.
I'd like that quite a bit. I have been looking for other projects, Ben. That would be a delight.
That would be great.
Friend of the podcast, Chuck Bryant, would hate that.
Friend of the podcast and best-selling author. Do you know that their Stuff You Should Know book is like a New York Times bestseller?
Yeah. The only mark against Chuck Bryant is that we've, for some reason, given him veto power on the crossover episodes we do with Friendly Fire and him.
That's
the
true.
The horror movie podcast.
Yeah. We kind of got it. We almost had beef with Chuck Bryant over the summer because of a misunderstanding about what Friendly Fire episode we were going to make with him.
Yeah, I believe, and we've gotten this note before about Friendly Fire by a Reddit commenter in particular who was like, I wish Friendly Fire only did good movies.
I would say that's most commenters.
I didn't read the user tag of that person, but it could have been you/Chuck Bryant.
Yeah, I would say that it's likely that it was. I mean, it's annoying that we have to do bad movies for that show. We don't always know that they're bad going in, though. And sometimes we disagree. You know, you, for example, loved Pearl Harbor, and John and I hated it.
Look, I think the one thing that you know about me more than any other quality is that I'm a completionist. We're going to do all the war movies for Friendly Fire.
Yeah.
Including the bad ones.
We're going to do...
Just as we have done all of
the Star Trek
The Next Generation, including the bad ones, and all of Deep Space Nine, including the bad ones.
We had a runner about not being completionists. Those vetoes,
yeah.
They really worried some people.
One of the best parts of that show.
Yeah. I feel like my knowledge of Voyager is a little bit better than my knowledge of Deep Space Nine.
Are we bringing vetoes back?
We could. I mean, I would have an unfair advantage because the sense that I get is that your knowledge of Voyager is fairly limited, right?
It's not limited. It's non-existent.
You never watched it at all?
I think I saw Year of Hell.
Oh,
that two-parter.
That's a classic.
And that might have been it.
Wow.
Right now, I'm thinking about Brie Belke, like, putting her face in her hands,
yeah.
Just shaking with anger at me.
Now, remind me, Year of Hell is the episode about Voyager traveling back to 2020?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and then Janeway crashes the ship into... what does she crash it into, Ben?
I
was going to say... But that would put me on a list I don't want to be on.
Yeah. The San Francisco Bay, man.
Right, right. That's an easy one. No one's going to get hurt like that.
Yeah, maybe crash into a humpback whale. But there's plenty of those now.
Yeah, they really fucked their way out of being endangered.
Yeah.
Good for them.
Yeah. I think there's like tens of thousands of humpbacks now.
Now the ocean is just foamy with whale sperm.
Yeah. And it's sperm just, whales, you know, both.
Honestly, it's too much.
Yeah. Get a room, whales.
Whales famously finding beds unnecessary to do their business, but in today's episode, beds and their associated fellows, very much a thing.
Indeed. Do you want to get into season 7, episode 19, Strange Bedfellows?
Do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
19 just feels like we're almost at the end.
It blew me away that we were on episode 19.
Wei-Yun is psyched to watch Worf and Esri do it in the opening scene. That was the biggest takeaway for me. Worf and Esri are brought to the wedding chamber that was hinted on in the final scene of the last episode, this brain dominion unification is a big, big deal, and Wei Yun is gloating about this.
He
and
says, also, "Welcome to the Tick. Now, we invite you to bone in prison."
"I find interspecies mating rituals fascinating to watch.
And what's going on here seems pretty pervy, doesn't it?"
Which is all the more confusing because in subsequent scenes, Worf and Ezri are like hanging by their legs.
Yeah.
And stuff. Like, how does he expect them to do anything?
You can't physically comfort yourself when you're upside down.
Can't be done.
Unless you're David Carradine.
Yeah, David Carradine, famous upside-down comer.
Yeah, he tried to hang himself right side up and come, and it went very badly for him.
Yeah.
When you're an autoerotic asphyxiation man, that's called the Stranger.
Yeah, I mean, hanging upside down makes me think that you could rightly be called the Batman.
"I'm not going to bury another Batman."
Yeah. We get a scene where Change Leader comes up to the bridge of the Tick, and she's super flaky, maybe even flakier than she was in the last episode. And
yeah.
And she kind of like gets herself together a little bit. It's sort of what, like, she does for herself, sort of what I do when somebody's taking a photo of me and I'm in a bathing suit, like kind of suck everything in, try and look presentable for the camera. She doesn't want the Breen leader to know how sick she is.
Yeah, so she sucks in her flakes.
The Breen leader, his name is Gore. Their name is Gore. I don't know what gender they are, but their rank is Thought.
Thought Gore.
Thought Gore. That hoe over there, Gore. I couldn't believe my ears.
True enough. And we never hear words spoken by the Breen. It's all static and crackles.
Yeah, they make fun of Damar for not having his universal translator. Like, I don't know if he like didn't download the app update before they left or something. But he can't understand them initially, but then later he can, but we still can't. And I feel like Star Trek almost never does that to us. It never pulls this Star Wars thing of somebody is beeping and booping or speaking an alien language and everyone is just like, "Yeah, I know what Chewbacca means when he says brrr."
I think the show has made quite an investment in making Damar a sympathetic character, and I think this is part of it. He's frustrated by being unable to understand what's going on around him and what people are saying, and by putting the viewer in that same position, I think that's a part of this whole deal.
I wondered what he was going through on this ship, because I know that if you get really addicted to alcohol and then you like stop drinking it for a long stretch, you can have withdrawal symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of seems like he goes for a lot of this episode without being in binge mode.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if he was like suffering under those conditions in a way that was just left implied.
Yeah, he's really going through some things, clearly. And yeah, that's another aspect to him that makes him sympathetic.
He's pissed about the treaty, right? Like, the Breen are going to be coming into the Dominion, and part of the treaty between the Dominion and the Breen that Damar is being asked to sign has him signing away swaths of Cardassian territory, entire planets, to the Breen. And he's like, "What the fuck, man? Like, I don't even know which planets I'm signing away. I don't want to do that."
"You were implying that Cardassian territory doesn't belong to the Founders. Surely that isn't what you meant."
He needs to get the wet version of the contract, Ben. The wet version is something you and I have been recently made aware of.
Yeah.
When you do business with certain entities, it's not enough to do a digital signature. There's also
DocuSign
the expectation
will not suffice.
Yeah, there is not DocuSign wet yet that we're aware of. Though that might be a North Hollywood bit of business.
I'll have the burrito mojado and the contracto mojado, por favor. Right.
It isn't just irritating to Damar, it's actually threatening, because you never want to sign a contract you haven't read. Damar is doing the diligence of having read the contract, and he's still not getting any information that he needs from it.
"Oh, you needn't worry about that."
He clearly has a problem with alcohol, but is also like capable enough to when somebody gives him an iPad with a contract in it, like read through it and like catch shit that is fucked up about it.
And just a note, this is the baseline level of incredulity that Damar will be feeling this episode.
This is outrageous.
It's all upward from here. Because there's also a situation on Septimus 3 that mm-hmm. could end up being a bloodbath. Ben, Damar wants to deviate the Klingons that are currently there, but Weyoun wants him to take a deep breath before making any decisions.
He's like, I wish I could, but I need that operation.
I'm reluctant to get it, though, because I've heard it's very painful.
Yeah.
Talk to Thought Gore. Express your concerns.
Back on Deep Space Nine, Martok and Siskow are gloating about how excited they are that the Septimus III campaign is going so well. In a way that, like, later in the episode, this scene seemed, like, really fucked up to me. Because we find out that this is, what this represents is 500,000 Cardassians being killed.
Old men and walking wounded, they don't stand a chance.
I think you're right.
This is going great.
Captain Sisko's like, it's great for us, Septimus, for the rest of us.
Martok is all about them feats of strength.
Martok pivots, much like Captain Sisko did in the last episode, from the business to the personal,
mm-hmm.
because he's there. He was not present at Ben Sisko's wedding, which was unfortunate.
My invitation must have been lost in the mail. No matter! I congratulate you on the fortuitous marriage of you to that freighter captain.
Let us agree that marriage is terrible.
We are two long-suffering men, beset on all sides by the wills of our wives.
This story that he tells about Sirella basically killing his dog is awful. And if we had heard this story before we met Sirella, I would have liked her even less.
Yeah, totally insane.
Sirella totally Duck Phillips'd Martok's Targ.
What more do you need to know?
If you were looking for a podcast that combined Mad Men references with Star Trek Deep Space Nine characters, this
you
is
found
the place.
It. Yeah, welcome. You are home.
It's a fun story told well by a fun actor, but the story itself, horrifying.
I mean, I think that it's like interesting character building for Martok, though, right? Because what he describes love and marriage as is an intoxicating war. Like, the fact that there is conflict in his marriage is the thing for him. And I know marriages like this, where, like, I have a couple friends where the conflict is what they're there for. And
I could not live like that.
It can be a little unsettling for very conflict-averse people like you and I.
It can be unsettling when you go out to dinner together.
I know. Yeah. I had a friend in college who just, it was like a 10 out of 10, like, debate or fight, one of the two, whenever his girlfriend was around. And I would, like, try and, like, calm things down and counsel them. And he pulled me aside at one point. He was like, no, like, me and Tammy like that. That's what we want. And I was like, oh.
My grandparents used to fight like that. Like, I was a very little kid when I would go stay with my grandparents, and they would fight hard.
Wow.
All the time. Like, my granddad got out of a moving vehicle one time mid-fight. Like, that's how hard they would fight. And I'm in the back like, what the fuck? Like, or whatever the equivalent is to an 8-year-old.
Yeah. What do 8-year-olds say for what the fuck?
But they loved each other very much.
Yeah. That's sweet.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of love, Adam, Gul Dukat and Kai Winn literally feeding each other fruit in bed, and they're making Solbor bring the fruit.
Are you happy, Adami?
More than I've ever been in my life.
First you want to kill me, now you want to kiss me. Blow.
Yeah, they go from one fruit bowl to the next, looks like.
Yeah. Better fruit bowl than you usually get in a hotel like this, right? Like, I didn't see any honeydew melon on this plate. And that really speaks well of the accommodations on Deep Space Nine.
Post-coital fruit platter, kind of a nice thing to have, I think.
Yeah.
Put the electrolytes back up, get the blood sugar equalized.
Yeah, and like if there's pineapple on that plate, it might speak well of the next time you get down.
Gul Dukat. The cut. Gul Dukat. So,
This is a scene that made me wonder, at what point do you foresee Gul Dukat becoming Kai?
Mm.
And this is probably a question that reveals to everyone listening that I've never seen the end of this show, or makes me a prophet for guessing.
Yeah, they're in this scene scheming on the emissary. And, you know, Kai Winn is kind of wondering if she's going to have the strength to do it. But it's also interesting because they've really, like, fallen into this dynamic. Like, the two of us are going to do what the prophets mm-hmm. ask us to do together. But we are, like, still waiting for the call. We don't know what the mission is going to be just yet.
Yeah, and so it's all about this mutual confidence building between the two of them.
Right. And where do you build confidence, Adam? The mirror. This is a episode directed by René Auberjonois, and a large portion of this scene takes place in the reflection of the vanity mirror on Kai Winn's desk.
Yeah.
Like that.
It's fun to take an angle like that when you're directing a scene this way.
I pray that I'll have the strength to do what the prophets are asking of me.
Speaking of love, Adam... In the next scene, Worf and Ezri are comforting themselves in that animalistic way, hanging from the ceiling.
I think you gotta tease the hair out a little more for this scene, if you're setting it up, right?
Yeah,
I didn't get the sense they were in this position very long because the hair isn't totally blown out.
If Worf hadn't been in his bun, I feel like then we would have seen some shit, right?
You can hear it in his voice, though. It sounds like it's a strain to be hanging upside down if you're Michael Dorn.
I doubt that is what our captors had in mind.
This is another moment where we're with people being tortured, and then we cut back across to Sisko, like, chilling out and living his normal life.
Yeah, cooking, not thinking about the fact that Worf and Ezri are missing still.
It's not a good look.
Did Worf and Ezri come up one single time in the last episode?
I don't think they did. I'm thinking back on the episode where initially Ezri jaked the shuttle and Odo presses Ben Sisko on why he's just going to let her do it. And then he goes, you know, Dax gone Dax. And that being the last time it's ever brought up.
Yeah.
I feel like something could have happened there constructively that forgave all of the scenes that followed where it seems like Sisko is ignoring that situation in a cruel kind of way.
Because, like, over the course of this episode, the concern increases on the station. But we know that it's been, like, at least a week at this point.
Yeah.
So very concerning that that nobody has even brought it up. And... This is a scene about the intoxicating war beginning.
Right, because Cassidy has returned from a cargo run while Sisko's at the oven preparing a meal. And she mentioned something about things changing between her and the Bajoran crew, which is like, finally, we get some Cassidy Yates, at least a little bit of agnosticism from her about the prophet thing.
Right.
And... I think this is interesting. This creates an interesting dynamic. The thing that I don't agree with in this scene is that you should never start an argument with someone who's preparing your food.
Right.
And that's what Cassidy does.
Yeah, because he invites her to, like, run some ceremony he does for women that want to get pregnant. And, like, he's like, it would really mean a lot to them if you gave them your blessing or whatever. And she's like, I'm... for sure never going to do that. That's not my bag. I didn't convert to your religion, and I'm not going to do it. Instead, I'm going to go take a shower. And he has, like, a jar of spices in his hands when she slams the door on his dick, and he switches to a different jar of spices when she does that. And I was
Is the suggestion that those are spices that she hates?
Yeah, for sure he just, like, put ghost chilies in the fucking jambalaya.
Yeah. Cassidy will be taking another shower later on in the evening.
It's an intoxicating war, Adam. An intoxicating war.
And so, the battle begins.
Speaking of love, Adam, Worf and Ezri are... collaborating on a project of trying to pry a pin out from underneath the cot in their cell on Cardassia Prime, which is where they've been brought by Change Leader's Tick. The pry does not go well, Enterprise, especially for Ezri, who bonks her noggin and cuts her finger and blames all of this on Worf.
Are you hurt?
Call me Mr. Butterfingers.
It seems like she would be the one to work underneath the bunk, though, given how big he is, right?
I know. No, it doesn't make sense.
She can get in there easy.
I mean, what really caused the bonk is this argument about who seduced who when they crashed on that planet a few episodes ago. And this is brewing into a full-throated argument.
The insults start flying back and forth. Like, she calls him a giant ego, and they're pissed at each other. I mean, pissed because they fucked on the planet, and I think they're both basically embarrassed about it.
I seduced you.
At least we agree on that point.
What?
And they don't get the opportunity to go to their separate corners and be alone with it. Like, they've got to confront it and each other for all this time that they're together.
Mm-hmm. Because Weyoun at the beginning was like, put them in the same cell so that the dramatic tension can be higher.
Right. Weyoun is there to introduce even more stress to them because they're war criminals now, Ben.
Yeah.
And they're due to stand trial, a trial in which they will be found guilty and executed.
He comes in with this iPad and he's like, this is, you know, when they put the clip show devices on you guys last episode, it didn't work great. So if you guys could clear up a couple of the like Mad Libs parts of this, that would be great. And he kind of puts Ezri's horniness for Julian Bashir on main in a way that really crushes Worf. Like, you can see the like third party confirmation of Worf's worst fears realized, and just a relentless trip to the ball kicking machine for him.
Worf's violence is so instantaneous here. It was pretty terrifying. Like, if all it takes is the reference of something to irritate him, to get him into neck-snapping mode.
What if every time Bashir came up for the rest of the season, Worf killed a man?
Yeah, Worf does this neck-snap with the confidence and skill of a man who's done this 1,000 times before.
Yeah.
And it's in a situation that Damar has seen maybe 1,000 times before. I mean, it doesn't even make his dick move positions.
You should have killed me. There's only one Damar.
This does nothing for him, seeing Weyoun die.
Yeah. So, Weyoun dead, and Damar's like, I don't really give a shit. Like, I've kind of lost the zeal of my allegiance. Like, he hasn't lost his allegiance, but
someone sprinkle some cat litter over Weyoun's body. We'll go on with the rest of our day.
That's gonna start to smell in a few days.
Yeah, that's some rugged torture right there. You leave Weyoun's body in the cell.
Yeah, to me, this is like a pretty long time now that Damar has gone not being drunk. And the next scene is Kai Winn getting faded again. And I feel like at this point in the episode, I'm going like, wow, like they have really changed roles. Like, now Winn is the lush and Damar is like serious villain guy.
They're at that point in a new relationship where they fucked a lot. And now is the time where you get to know the person you've been fucking so much lately.
Who are you?
Your worst nightmare.
I mean, I want to know everything.
Yeah, I loved the part of my relationship with my wife where she never got out of a white gossamer robe.
Yeah, Kaiwin's not going to be wearing white for long.
The wine that they're drinking is also the like really fancy shit, right?
The gift wine.
Yeah.
For the Cisco wedding.
Yeah.
That's gotta hurt.
It's a pre-war vintage, and she's given it to Dukat.
Gul Dukat's like, it tastes a little different not drinking it out of a hollowed-out Bajoran skull.
Not drinking it out of a because I would never
right,
do that.
I would never do that.
I'm a man of the land with a plan.
Sure.
I wear a caftan. I drive a van. Definitely not a Cardassian.
Kaiwyn is interrupted by a prophet vision in the scene. What she believes to be a prophet vision. She gets right on the ground and starts licking boot. And mid, like after about the seventh or eighth boot that gets licked, what she believes were the prophets reveal themselves to be Pares.
Twist!
At which point she's like, Patooey, gross. These are not the boots I thought I was licking.
I mean, I knew boots weren't supposed to taste good, but this is ridiculous.
Right, and this is a shattering moment for Kaiwyn.
Because she believed that she was talking to the prophets the last time, and this reveal shakes her to her core. She definitely wanted to be doing a mission for the prophets and is loyal to them. Did you understand what the Sisko Pa Wraith had in its hand?
Yeah, that's a weird reference.
Is it like a branch Pyrathian earring?
I wonder if it was in reference to the story she told in the last episode about the jewels that she traded. Because it didn't look quite like a earring or a necklace to me. It looked like stones of some kind.
Yeah, I couldn't decode it. I'd be curious to know what that was about.
We've gotten a version of Louise Fletcher's Kaiwyn for so long that to get this gear out of her, I thought was a real treat. The shattered Kaiwyn.
Yeah.
The not confident version, the not scheming version, the Kaiwyn that's lost it all. I thought it was just a really great performance.
I did too. And one thing I really loved about this moment at the end of the vision is in the vision, she shouts no, and she's also shouting no in reality, and they cut right in the middle of the no. So it's like one word carried across two planes of existence in the edit.
No! No!
And yeah. It was really effective. I really liked that touch.
In the aftermath of this, Kaiwyn needs Gul Dukat to bring her the orb in order to get forgiveness.
Yeah.
She's got to get into some kind of council.
She's got to get right with gods.
And Gul Dukat's happy to do this. Once he leaves and goes out into the hallway, he is smiling ear to ear. This plan is going great for him.
Yeah, he starts whistling. He clicks his heels together.
He buys 2 Jumja sticks out on the promenade and licks them both.
Yeah.
On Cardassia, Damard is into the bottle when Wayun 8 walks in.
Yeah, it seems like he's maybe just getting started, but he's like, he's really having a great time.
Yeah.
He's back on the sauce.
The death of a Wayun is always worthy of celebration.
You know, their prisoners are going to get executed. It's all scheduled. It's going great. They're not going to be participating in any filling in of gaps. And Wayun also invites the Breen into the command center, into the room. They can see the big board, and this kind of freaks Damar out. His mood really turns in this moment because the Breen start like looking through the computer systems. There are classified databases and stuff, and Wayun has really just thrown the doors wide open to these guys.
When the Breen join the tour group at Cheyenne Mountain, they assume they also have computer access.
Yeah.
And no one's stopping them. This is filling Damar with consternation.
Yeah.
Because this is the moment where he realizes that he's been demoted below Thotgor.
This is a huge embarrassment for him. And Wayun's like, nothing I can do, bro. This comes right from Trangeleader. She fucking hates your guts.
You know she hates you, right? This yeah. can't be a surprise. You're always complaining about the thermostat.
Yeah.
I was telling you to stop complaining. But you didn't listen.
I will not.
I love that Ezri and Worf's jailbreak scene pays off with the jailbreak. Like the door is open, which is something I'd never expected Worf to be able to do. They're out, and then like the music swells, and like we get the action scene. I'm like, yes, they're getting the hell out of here.
They're phasering guys in the like carpeted hallways of the Cardassian detention center.
We cut to that angle around the corner, and then it's over. Like, it's over as fast as it starts.
Yeah, they're surrounded. Worf takes one in the leg. He's kind of fucked up. But yeah, the escape does not go well, Enterprise.
Yeah.
Back on Deep Space Nine, at the bar, Quark has been keeping a sort of vigil for Esri, where he fills a glass with her favorite, I don't know, wine or something. The bar crew is really worried about Esri. Not a line about Worf in this entire scene, but Bashir, O'Brien, and Quark very sad that Esri's gone.
They all agree to maybe say something to Captain Sisko about maybe trying to get them back at some point. Yeah. They haven't decided who's going to do that.
Maybe when the bloom is off the rose with the wedding a little bit, you know. Let's give them a couple of weeks, but...
I love that Quark is like the dancer from the Dirty Vegas Days Go By video. He's pouring the drink to bring her back, Ben.
One of these days, Esri's going to come walking through those doors again. And this drink is going to be sitting right here waiting for her when she does.
It seems like more of a waste of booze than Quark would typically be interested in, though.
I thought about
that. You can tell
that's
how strong his feelings are, is that he's willing to... lose a little bit.
The margin on whatever beverage that is must be really big, right? I'm not really losing that much profit.
I like that Bashir in the scene kind of eulogizes his relationship to Esri and can't quite even get the words out.
Yeah, the way he is kind of lost in a reverie. He's not in control of his own emotions, that he can't form a coherent thought almost.
And he's a super genius.
Yeah.
So you know if he can't make the words, something's really wrong.
Something bad is happening.
Yeah. So the orb arrives in Kai Wynn's quarters, and Kai Wynn is ready to open them doors and get into it with the orb. But when she does, nothing happens.
Yeah.
It is a huge bummer, and it made me... I thought really hard about what's supposed to happen when you open the doors. Do you get right into it immediately? And there's that pregnant moment where Kai Wynn opens the doors to the orb and nothing happens.
She's washed in that bright white light.
She's devastated.
Yeah.
No! No!
And this is where Angel / Dukat can kind of unveil the prestige.
Yeah. He takes it... out.
He reveals that he did not stumble into her office as a wayward farmer looking for a blessing for his next month's crop. He's been working with the Branch Pyrathians the entire time, and she starts to freak out and struggle with him.
She fucking slaps him with the weakest slap maybe we've ever seen on TV, and it made me wonder if they had some sort of deal on set about how hard Louise Fletcher was going to slap Mark Alamo.
Yeah.
I really wanted to take the bark off of him a little bit.
I thought it was kind of interesting because I almost interpreted it like she starts pounding on his chest and it really feels like she's pulling it, but it also kind of feels like she is so weakened by this kind of collapse of her concept of reality that she has no fight in her.
That makes sense.
And he is giving her the Branch Pyrathian pitch, right? The prophets didn't do anything during the occupation. They turned their backs on Bajor. Why are you venerating these gods that don't give a shit about you? Kind of a line. And
when you hear this list of indignities, it's fairly persuasive.
Right. It's what's persuasive about atheism in general is why is the world so fucking terrible if there's some loving God somewhere.
Gul Dukat's look, we're just going to need to brand you with the GDK initials right here. It's not weird.
You're going to think it's the initials for Angel, but it's actually the initials for Gul Dukat.
Right. We're going to slot you into a real master-servant situation here.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to need you to text me some pictures of your butt.
Yeah. But what's interesting about this scene is I think a weaker episode would have had Kai Wynn capitulate in the face of all of this proof that Gul Dukat's giving her that she's been fucking up the entire time. And at the end of this scene, Kai Wynn is seeming to reject the offer.
Yeah. She tells him to fuck off, and then she is slumped against the wall, basically begging this orb to tell her what to do, because she is so terrified that she has spent even a few moments in league with the bads.
I love this bit of business here with how this shot and this scene is composed, because we're in on Louise Fletcher as she's doing the begging and we're pulling out.
Yeah.
And I don't think a viewer can be sure that she's not begging Gul Dukat in this scene.
Yeah.
And when it's finally revealed to be the orb box, there was a little bit of relief on my part, seeing that she is of the same mind as she was in the previous scene.
Right.
With that desperation to have a proper prophet experience and one that can forgive her.
Morn.
Dear sweet.
Morn.
You near, buddy?
Morn.
Stop. Have a time.
She summons Colonel Kira to her quarters, and I feel like the Kai Winn crisis of faith scene and confession to Colonel Kira is why you cast Louise Fletcher.
Yeah.
Like, this is like two giants of acting in a really intense scene together. Like, Nana Visitor and Louise Fletcher hitting this ball back and forth was so intense.
I love that when it's clear that Kai Winn has misunderstood what Kira is really saying, like the subtext of her advice, there's something so threatening about that moment. Because, like, initially, this is a power imbalance, right? Kai Winn has asked for help from a Kira who is giving that help, and it appears for a moment that they are on the same level.
Right.
But once Kai Winn decides that that this is bad advice, that she's not going to take for action, of course she's not going to stop being Kai, she seizes that power right back.
Yeah.
And it's scary the moment she does.
It really is. The dynamics in the scene, like, really blew my hair back, because...
Yeah.
Kai Winn brings Kira in because she has lost her direction. Like, she feels backed into a corner. She's betrayed. She almost has nothing. And mm-hmm. by the end of the scene, she is, like, back to full scary villain in a way that really surprised me.
Bajor needs me.
And you could say scarier as a villain, because now she's less predictable.
It almost feels like she brought Kira in because Kira is, like, the thing that she bounces against as a villain so often, mm-hmm. that just the idea of bringing Kira in is, like, enough for her to recalibrate and remember what she stands for.
It's interesting that twice in successive episodes we've had a major Bajoran religious figure ask Kira for advice.
Mm-hmm.
And both times that advice has been rejected, both by Sisko and by Kai Winn here, right?
Kira's got to start getting a little bit nervous about what this means.
Yeah, I think she's going to start turning down invitations.
Yeah, sorry, I don't really give advice to major figures in my religion anymore. It's just not gone well for me in the past.
Both Captain Sisko and Kai Winn have asked Kira for advice about how to start a podcast, and neither of them took the advice that Kira gave. That feels familiar.
Yeah. Great scene with Wei Yun and the Breen yucking it up, and Damar is revealed to be in the room, and they're saying, like, oh, yeah, like, this part of the war is going super well, and... Damara's like, yeah, but the Septimus thing. Like, we talked about the Septimus at the beginning of the episode and how important it was to deal with that. And
I got the Septimus pole and everything.
Yeah.
We were going to do feats of strength.
Yeah. We're going to do the airing of grievances. I mean, this is going to be a whole thing.
Have you not heard me the entire time? I've been airing grievances.
Jay Peterman came. Like, people are enthusiastic about this for once.
This is the tipping point. Damar is very angry about the Septimus III situation, and this confrontation with Wei Yun 8 goes poorly.
Listen, I will explain.
No!
The 500,000 loyal Cardassians that were left to perish did not get any backup. Nobody came to save the day for them. And Wei Yun is like, yeah, because we were letting the Klingons commit tons of resources to Septimus III, which doesn't have any strategic importance. This is going awesome for us. Like, this Breen alliance is great. And if Cardassians have to suffer at times to serve the Founders, then it's their honor to do so.
The suffocation at Septimus III will never be forgotten. Damar's never going to get over this.
Yeah. So he kind of storms out of the room. Weiyun and Thotgore make a comment about how hard it is to get a day's work out of Damara these days. And another Breen in the corner goes, "Wow, this kitty has claws." Only it's like, bzz, 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 bzz. And then we get the famous scene where Damar chucks a glass of Kadar against a mirror. It is so nasty.
That mirror is never going to be the same.
Yeah, you can't clean that. Like, you'd have to put it through like a dishwasher.
You're going to need one of those razor blades to like that you get bubble gum out of a piece of concrete floor with.
Yeah.
Great moment.
Indeed.
The viscosity really makes all the difference here.
Yeah. If only the bottle of Kanar that our listener made for us had that much viscosity to it. Oh, well.
Yeah. So Ezri and Worf are starting to lose hope and accept their fate as people about to be executed.
Yeah.
But they still have enough time to argue about Ezri and Jadzia and why the situation has been so challenging for them.
I hate to burst your bubble, Worf, but it wasn't that good.
I really liked this scene. I like both them blocking, which is pretty simple, but very like elegant and well done. And the kind of color palette of the scene are really nice. Like it's dark, but then when there's any light, it's these deep, rich reds and browns. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of having this scene where they agree, like, oh, we both fucked up. Like, we fell for each other by kind of rounding each other up into something that we knew we weren't going to be.
It's two fairly immature characters arriving at a mature conclusion.
Yeah. Yeah. I really liked it. And I liked how they left it. And I like that it ends with them getting to escape.
Yeah. Because Worf admits to not loving Ezri as much as Jadzia.
Yeah.
And the thing they agree about is that maybe there was a kind of ankylosaur rebound happening.
Yeah.
And maybe that's all it is.
And all that darkness and like cozy closeness like evaporates when the doors open and like all the light from the hallway is cast on them. Mm-hmm. And reality enters again. And Damara's there with a couple of Jem'Hadars to walk them to their execution, and Damar shoots the Jem'Hadars, gives them the rifles, and tells them how to escape from Cardassian space.
There's a Cardassian patrol ship sitting in Launch Bay 3A, two levels above us.
Do we know how Cardassians execute? I feel like that would have been a fun little drip of trivia here. Like, yeah. I wanted to know where they were headed, what exactly was going to happen to them.
Yeah.
Because that helps me be afraid of a thing, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, that helps me get on the side of Worf and Ezri if it's like, we're going to stick you in front of a fine mesh screen and push. like that. Give me the detail of that so I have something to fear.
That would have helped, absolutely.
I don't know about you, but I fear the known way more than the unknown.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point. That would have been good.
What an alien culture values is so interesting as much as how they choose to kill you, I think.
Mm-hmm. You can really learn a lot about a guy by the way he'd like to end your life.
I mean, that's classic serial killer pathology, right? Like that's where you start. Like the method of death is how you begin to figure out where a serial killer's coming from.
Yeah. The news reaches Weiyun and Thotgore, and Weiyun, he just looks like he's had his pants pulled all the way down. You know, he is right. Freaking out. You know, Change Leader wants to see him. He knows that that's not going to go well.
Yeah, much like Kai Winn showing up for a meeting right on the heels of the disillusion of the Sisko marriage. Like, this is a terrible moment for a meeting with Change Leader if you're Weiyun 8.
Yeah, but Worf and Ezri heading back to Deep Space Nine with the news that the drunkest man on Cardassia is their friend.
You know what's going to be great in the next episode is Ezri and Worf showing up on Deep Space Nine and everyone just being very surprised to see them.
Oh, I remember you guys.
There better be an explanation to this when they get back. Do you think there's a way to tie this up in a way that makes any sense? There's got to be a reason
for
Sisko's inaction here.
I wish I felt like I knew.
Yeah, well, we'll find out when the viewers do next week.
Yeah.
I vote for option one.
The button on the episode is Dukat getting his Kai.
Yeah, she's been turned. She admits to Gul Dukat that her faith in the prophets has always been performative.
This was so interesting to me. I always wonder this about, like, the Benny Hinns of the world. Like,
yeah.
Like, are these people that are, like, so craven in the way they perform their faith really people that totally lack faith and are, like, terrified by that fact?
Yeah, they would seem to be the engine for that performance.
Right. And I think she is so interestingly written. I mean, it really reminded me of, like, recent political shit in this country, like the just like, oh, I got this power that I didn't actually think I was gonna get, so I'm going to embrace like the ugliest version of that kind of thing.
Right, and assuming a mandate where none exists.
Yeah. So she is she's going full Branch Pyrathian, and they're gonna walk this path that the Pyraths have set out for them together.
I have worked too hard, waited too long to give it all up now.
And the last line of the episode is about how they're going to like sweep aside the Federation and the emissary of the prophets. Pretty dark stuff. It's like it almost feels like a third front in the war is opening up.
Yeah, and the thing is, the Federation doesn't know about this.
Yeah, this is still a surprise waiting to happen. Yeah.
Well, did you like this episode, Ben?
You really want to do this here now?
I did like the episode. I know that we're in kind of the early stages of a big long arc, but this felt like a great sequel to a great, like, last episode and this episode feeling especially related to each other, and this feeling like a great sequel to the last episode is kind of what I'm trying to put my finger on.
Yeah, I agree. I keep wanting to consume this series faster in a way that is unfamiliar up until now. Like, I've been pretty happy with watching several episodes a week for the purposes of our show, but I keep wanting to watch ahead in a binge kind of fashion because I want to see where this goes. And I think part of the reason for that is I'm having a hard time predicting where all of this ends.
Yeah.
I think the show's done a very good job of obscuring what could be pretty tropey situations. They've managed to avoid things like that in favor of some pretty surprising elements at this point. So I'm pretty satisfied with the story as it is right now, and I'm looking forward to more.
There's a pretty rich threading of story going on right now, and it's really cool to watch. I'm enjoying it too.
Yeah.
Adam, do you want to see if we have any Priority One messages in the inbox?
P1's always threaded through the fabric of our show like a hairpiece.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Can't even see the work. Ben, our first Priority One message is of a promotional nature.
Okay.
The message goes like this. Leadership. The final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starfleet Leadership Academy. Its ongoing mission, to develop leaders through Star Trek to boldly go where no podcast has gone before.
Wow.
The Starfleet Leadership Academy is a Star Trek podcast told through the lens of leadership development. Jeff Aiken, a leader with over 20 years of executive management experience, breaks down each episode of Star Trek and points out examples of great leadership, management, Lean Six Sigma, and more.
Lean Six Sigma? What's that?
I was familiar with Six Sigma during some time spent at a previous workplace. Would actually be a little time-consuming to go into, but...
Okay,
but well... You can find out more about programs like this by looking into the Starfleet Leadership Academy podcast on all the podcast places or by visiting podfollow.com/SFLA. So yeah, check that out. Kind of a different twist on a Star Trek podcast there.
Yeah.
I'm guessing there aren't going to be a lot of dick jokes on that one.
Yeah. I'm curious about that podcast. That sounds cool. Our next Priority One message, Adam, is from your father. And it is to Leon and Anna Sadowski. And it goes like this. Oh, boy, Adam, this looks like it's supposed to be read by you.
Oh, great. All right. Well,
here's the text.
Is it supposed to be in a voice?
I don't see anything like that. Anyways.
Since you guys were born, Adam and Ben have been like a couple of Guinans to your daddy's aunts and row. They kept my mood up when I was nursing a pink drink and 10 forward. Consider this your baptism, and these two...
He's a Borg!
Your godfathers. Love, Daddy.
Wow.
Hey, we just became godparents, Ben. That's all it takes.
Oh boy, that's a lot of responsibility. Well, I'll try not to be too insulted by the fact, Leon and Anna, that your father had Adam read that and not me.
Right.
But, you can come to me for anything, me being your godfather.
Yeah, you're the cool godfather.
Yeah, we always play a game of good godfather, bad godfather.
Right.
Anyways, would you like a cigarette, or can I get you a sandwich or something?
Well, the reading of a Priority One is an offer we can never refuse. You can make sure that we do that by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, where both personal and promotional messages go a long way in support of the ongoing production of this show.
Sure do. Hey, Adam.
It's that, Ben.
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible. Drunk Shimoda!
It feels like I've been very very actor-centric lately, and I think I'm going to give my Shimoda to Louise Fletcher, who is just expanding into the entire spectrum of character here.
Yeah.
Like, really, really filling the space with all that Kai Winn can be. I think that's not to say that Kai Winn's ever been one note or that Louise Fletcher has ever played her that way, but really interesting to see a character like hers go through the stages as she has to in this ep. So I think that deserves a Shimoda commendation. So I'm just going to give mine to her. What about you?
I'm going to give mine to Wei Yun. I love that scene where he's doing bits with Thotgor and the camera pulls back to reveal that Damar is in there also.
Yeah.
The cut into two characters like laughing their bellies off is always a fun moment. And I just, I really like Wei Yun in this episode.
Gotta get that cold press latch.
This episode is brought to you by the spring cleaning champions, Manscaped. This season, make sure to groom your carpets and your drapes, the leaders in below-the-waist grooming. Clear out your winter bush with Manscaped's Lawnmower 5.0 and watch your confidence bloom like the springtime flowers. Hey, maybe you're getting away on weekends, getting into a swimsuit, into a sexy situation, or you're not wearing pants at all. You want to look your best from head to toe. Get yourself some Manscaped products. You know, it doesn't just have to be your junk. You know, they've got the Beard Hedger Pro Kit and a Handyman Electric Face Shaver. They make great stuff, and I think you'll really enjoy it. And you'll get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants. Put your best foot forward and present your new business project or political thing as well as you possibly can on the internet. How do you do that? Not through some cookie cutter form on a social media website or trying and failing to code a pretty website yourself. No, you go to Squarespace, start using their completely new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint, which helps you choose from professionally curated layouts and styling options that help you build a unique online presence from the ground up that is tailored to your brand or business. Squarespace has been a super loyal sponsor of The Greatest Generation. We hope you will give them a try. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/scarves to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
It's Webby season. Hi, I'm Sequoia Holmes, host of the Black People Love Paramore podcast, and we are nominated for a Webby for the episode where I interviewed Hayley Williams. In case you're unfamiliar, Black People Love Paramore is a podcast delving into the common and uncommon interests of Black people in order to help us feel more seen. We would love your vote to help us win this Webby. Please take a second, go over to the Black People Love Paramore podcast social media accounts, and you can find them at BPLP Pod across all social media platforms. Hit the link in bio and vote for Black People Love Paramore.
Hi, I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Teresa McElroy.
And we're the host of Schmanners.
We don't believe that etiquette should be used to judge other people.
No, on Schmanners, we see etiquette as a way to navigate social situations with confidence.
So if that sounds like something you're into,
join us every Friday on Maximum Fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
We've got another episode coming up, Ben. It's the, part... four.
Yeah. Do you want to head to the Game of Buttholes, the Will of the Prophets at gach.biz/game? And I will tell you about season 7, episode 20, The Changing Face of Evil. The war reaches a crucial turning point when the Cardassian leader breaks from the Dominion Breen Alliance. It happened faster than I was expecting. I thought that they were going to like have Damar kind of lay back in the cut for a little while.
I know. Well, we're in kind of a hurry.
I guess so. Yeah, we are sprinting toward the end.
We're running out of season runway, aren't we?
Yeah.
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
Well, thanks to your great roll, Ben, we are currently on square 63 of the Game of Buttholes Will of the Prophets, and I've got a die in my hand. It's up to me to decide how far we go with this roll.
Okay. Lay a roll on us, my friend.
And I've rolled a 4.
Chula! Did I win?
Hardly.
Which sticks us on square 67.
Okay.
That's on the doorstep of a Jay Gordon episode and safely into a regular old episode. So we keep climbing toward our eventual end goal of a Mournhammered episode.
Yeah. What I mean, if we have to be Mournhammered on the finale of this series, which is a double hour and 30 minute long episode, we're gonna be so fucked.
Is the finale a 2-hour episode?
Yeah, it's a double.
Are we making the Greatest Generation episode a double, or are we splitting up the hours?
I think it aired as one thing, and I think it is kind of one thing, so...
Wow. You know how it's going to end up happening is that we're going to hit the Mournhammered episode like 3 episodes from the finale for the pre-penultimate episode, and then yeah. What do we do?
Oh, boy.
A hungover finale episode.
Yeah, that's what it'll be.
Can hardly wait.
Yeah, me neither. Hey, it's the holiday season as of the release of this episode. It's a bit, it's like last minute if you're a Christmas person. And a great last minute shopping idea is gifting a membership to The Greatest Generation to your favorite friend of DeSoto. You got a friend that likes this show but doesn't have access to the bonus feed, consider getting them that. Just head to MaximumFun.org/join and you can find information about how to set up a gift membership there.
Here's an idea. You can bewilder a friend of yours by giving a Maximum Fun membership as a white elephant gift. That they didn't ask for.
Oh, yeah.
Imagine the look of confusion as they open up the envelope and see membership to Maximum Fun.
What the hell did my Secret Santa even do? What is this?
There's always one of those in a white elephant gift exchange.
Yeah.
And that could be yours.
We really appreciate it. You know, obviously it's been kind of a tough year for a lot of people, and... We've been fortunate to survive this, but you know, if you got a couple extra bucks in your pocket and are in a position to throw it our way for whatever reason, we really, really appreciate it. And we also really appreciate the free ways that people support our show by recommending it to a friend or posting about how much they like it on social media or leaving us a nice review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app they use to get the show.
It's always exciting to see how many people are listening week to week. Pretty fun.
Indeed.
And to see how many people are watching.
Yeah.
Look at how many people are watching the show right now, Ben.
Crazy. Look at that. Oh, man. The comments are full.
I'm going to give them a wave.
They really appreciated that. All those hearts just started bubbling up. Hey, we got to thank Bill Tilley, who runs the social media accounts at Greatest Trek on Instagram and Twitter. We also got to thank Adam Ragusea, who made the original theme music for the program, riffing off the work of Dark Materia, who also gave us permission to use their work. And we really appreciate everybody that helps us get this thing to the folks every week.
Filled with gratitude. Well, with that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine. That is just a week away from the end of 2020.
When people are like listening back to this as an episode that they're just binging in 2024, they're gonna be like, what was the big deal about 2020? I can't even remember.
Yeah.
It's all been downhill since then.
And then that person walks out of their hole in the ground to go forage for food.
We joke, but we've made worse predictions come through before.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.